This is a podcast which makes vital listening, and one which we are especially delighted to be associated with here at The Carriage Commentator. The Brooke Charity was founded after a compassionate Scottish lady, Dorothy Brooke, went to live in Cairo in the 1930s and wanted to help the horses and working equids she saw there. So she set up an animal hospital. In the years since then, the Brooke Charity has grown into one of the most proactive and best known international animal charities, endeavouring to improve the welfare and care of millions of working equids in developing countries and communities. This is an inspirational and humbling conversation held over Zoom with Brooke's harness advisor, Jackie Hickman, and Jessica Maybanks, Brooke's philanthropy and partnerships advisor. To hear about the sorts of issues that Jackie encounters when she visits places like Senegal, Kenya, or Nicaragua, and how she tactfully and constructively tackles them to educate the community and improve the life of the working equids, be they driven, ridden, or load-bearing, stops you in your tracks. Bringing about improvements in a sensitive, practical, and enduring way involves undoing many traditions and changing human behaviours, which requires a lot of diplomacy, wisdom, and relationship building. As we look elsewhere on The Carriage Commentator at issues like breast collars and lines of draft, and how they impact our sport and pleasure equines, this is a salient time to share this conversation about parts of the world where you can't get next day delivery, where the challenges of feeding families and staying healthy are far greater than we will ever know, and the working horses, donkeys, and mules are the only means by which money can be earned. We began our discussion centering around the pandemic and COVID and the implications for Brooke and being able to travel. And both Jessica and Jackie actually said that business was able to continue pretty much as usual. So the first voice you hear is Jessica Maybanks from Brooke.
I mean, we're lucky at Brooke because we employ like the vast, vast majority of our staff, people that live and work in the communities where we operate. So actually, we have very few sort of UK members of staff like Jackie, who actually, you know, travel out to deliver that training. So the reason we have a role for Jackie with the harnessing and Angus, who does our farriery, is where that additional expertise is really needed. Then Jackie goes out and delivers the international sort of training workshops. But we have, you know, experts, veterinary experts, monitoring and evaluation experts, community development experts in all of our countries. So the work could continue, which was good. It just meant that, yeah, that our small team of international staff who go out couldn't during that time.
But did it impact the sorts of communities you were working with, or did life go on as normal for them? Because I don't know how widely spread in places like Senegal, Kenya and Ethiopia COVID even was.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it definitely affected things in terms of us having to take even more precautions than normal. Whenever we go to a community, we're, you know, absolutely scrupulous about sort of the need for the health and safety sort of implications. But for those communities that we work with, they are the most marginalized, you know, they are the poorest of the poor. So for them, you know, whilst there might have been sort of, what do they call it, like panic buying in the UK, and shelves became absent of certain items of food and things, they're living hand to mouth anyway. So it certainly made things a huge amount harder. And yeah, in certain instances, we had to provide sort of emergency support, as we do during any other emergency, be that a flood, a drought. So yeah, I think it's always the poorest people that get hit hardest in these instances, isn't it?
I mean, it is, as in all the endeavours that you do at Brooke, it is enormously humbling always, isn't it? From just a reminder of what we take for granted here in the Western world and the wealthy Western world to just the great work and what you're doing. And so, Jackie, the harness, because I also know Kate Hetherington, I remember her telling me at the time that a lot of what you have to do when you go out into the communities or the villages and developing countries, is that the best term for them still? Is you have to make the most of the materials that are available. And if that is old car tyres, then it's old car tyres. So what is your starting point when you go out to either examine the harness that's being used or to set up some training to improve the life of these incredible horses, donkeys and mules?
I looked through some of your questions. I was 24 years as an RSPCA inspector. I'm an equine officer for the RSPCA. And I used to get involved in doing a lot of international training. So I've been to Japan twice. And it's all sort of animal welfare based, but my focus was purely on equines. So I'm also a qualified farrier.
I saw that, the Hereford School of Farrier, wasn't it? Yes.
Yeah. So that's why I had, I think, 12 years as a farrier. But I was very interested in welfare and it wasn't going to be a long-term career for me. So I had a dream to be a farrier and then to be an RSPCA inspector. But my ultimate was one day I would get to work for Brooke. So I'm so lucky on my career path so far. So using all of the knowledge I've learned in my life to try and improve the harnessing systems across the world, basically. So
yes. So, because obviously the Farrow project for Brooke is huge. So you've got two for one, Jess, with Jackie, haven't you? You've got somebody that can go out there and help with the training.
We're so lucky to have Jackie.
All the way through.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes,
definitely.
Yeah, if I'm in a country doing a harness assessment and I see farriery things, I'll do two reports, one for farriery and work with Angus, because Angus is sort of only part-time as well. And it's very difficult to try and get to all of the country programmes because, you know, I've been so blessed with the travel that I have done, but then it's not just the visit, it's what happens after that. And a lot of things happen. And every single country has an extremely different context. So I've always had horses. I started driving horses with friends many years ago. I preferred driving to riding. I think I like that communication from a distance and being at one with the horse, but without having to rely on, you know, the physical strength, and people panic a little bit too much. So I've learned a lot. I'm learning to drive a pair of horses now, although one of them's got an eye problem. So I've even driven in Egypt, in Aswan, around the streets of Aswan. I drove a carriage around there. So I have a lot of friends who are sort of in the carriage driving world, but this is a completely different context. So there is no learning pathway harness makers in other countries, because for a start, a lot of countries don't have leather at all. A lot don't have a learning pathway. There is no sort of skill set. It's kind of traditional harnessing systems that have been passed down, or they've evolved from something that was developed for oxen. And with that lack of understanding and education, it's the first thing I like to do is get our own teams in Brooke to understand the fit and the function of a harness. So that is with some understanding of the context. So a lot don't use collars. You know, I've just spent a week in Kenya where we don't even have any bridles. There is no reins, there is no bridles, there is no bit, and they're only donkeys and they go very fast. So it's sort of a little understanding of the draft, you know, power of the animal, how we can avoid the wounds. So when animals are presented in any of our country programs with a wound, what I try to do is spend times with our vets and partner vets, not just to treat that wound, but to have a deeper understanding of what has caused the wound and how can we prevent it. You know, so it's not a case of just putting a plaster on, the animal will heal, then it can work again, because they will simply put the same system back on. So it's having more of an understanding, and to try and help me develop that, I've got sort of at least one representative per country that are now specialised in gaining some better skills and education in relation to harnessing. So each of the country is what we call a harnessing technical representative. So they're the ones that get additional training with the hope that a lot of the things can be cascaded down. because there is no learning pathway, we're very lucky in the UK. We have the Society of Master Saddlers, we have the Worshipful Company of Saddlers, and then these various bridle and bit fitting courses that, you know, we're working with them and they've invited me and I've done training there. But it's then, how do I adapt that into a context that suits pretty much a lot of people that they may not even have the skills to read or write. So a lot of my training can be practical. So for our own staff, yes, we can do the PowerPoint, the videos and some practical assessments. We've developed kind of an assessment tool, which gives them, you know, not just the confidence, but the competence to be able to say, we know this is wrong, but we don't know why. But now we can think about the friction, the pressure, the load bearing, you know, the type of animal, and it incorporates everything. It's everything. So we look at the fitness of the animal, the size of the animal, the size of the cart, the harness, because, I mean, we both know it's very difficult to say a horse can pull this weight, a donkey can carry this weight, because there is so many parameters. You know, the terrain, the type of vehicle, the type of load, the condition of the animal. And it's really difficult to put a black and white on this. So I will look at the animal welfare indicators. You know, is the horse or the donkey struggling? Is he leaning into the collar? Is it causing an indentation on the chest? So we have little exercises where we can have a simple piece of string that with a weighted tub of water, and they can see the impression it makes on their skin. Then we will just add some padding. It's a simple exercise. And then they can see that just spreading the load in the correct area will actually prevent that wound from developing in the first place. And some of the, you know, the quality of equipment that I've seen, especially with bits and blinkers, they're awful. A lot of it can actually be improved with what they already have, with an understanding of the horse has to be able to yawn, to open its mouth, to eat, to drink. If the animal is going along constantly with its mouth wide open, it's an indication there is something wrong. Is it a behavioural issue, or is the behavioural issue, you know, resulting from pain? Is the animal feeling pain? And then there's also the indicators that are not obvious. So is it tired? Is it stumbling? Do we have a situation where the owner is helping to pull the cart along? Do they constantly get flipped up into the air, which I've seen many, many times, because the cart balance is incorrect? And it's really difficult with all the different contexts to break that down. So I will start with an introduction. And every sort of one of our staff members will get an introduction to harness, and it will be kept basic. So there's no point talking about the physics and Newton's law and holding the reins in one hand and how many inches the wheel is. I've got basically half a cart with two scaffolding poles and a bit of rope. And we have to think about, this is the part of the animal that can pull the load. So they should not be carrying it on their neck, which is what's happening in a lot of countries. You know, I'm doing a project in Kenya, which is quite exciting, where we're developing a new cart, but it has to be based on what the community need the cart to do and the welfare of the donkeys. But also the retraining of the donkeys is very important to me, because you can't simply expect an animal to adopt a new system or a community, because it can be done wrong and we risk, you know, that them being a misunderstanding. So my motto is, you know, that your horse should work with you, not for you. And if there is a situation where any animal is at risk, then it's something that we won't do. Because I think one of the things we have to consider with harnessing is we could make something better, but that could have a knock-on effect and make something else worse. So it's the overall understanding of what are we trying to achieve. You know, we want these horses, these donkeys and these mules to be comfortable in their work, happy in their work, and we want them to work as a partnership with the owners. And it's about quality at rest. Everything to do with harnessing from Brooke's perspective is anything that we put onto the animal for the purpose of mankind or womankind. So we even include sessions on hobbling and tethering and restraint at rest. So how are the animals restrained? So everything from a basic rope halter right the way through to the cart itself, anything that we put onto the equine for the purpose of work comes under sort of my umbrella, if you like. But I can only achieve that if I work with our compassionate handling, our veterinary teams, because it's all linked. So some countries, we are having some huge success by bringing together the harness makers, the cart makers, and the bit makers, and it's working well. So they would never think before. So maybe an example. In Senegal, my first visit to Senegal was more of an exploratory visit, but I was part of, you know, what we call an equine welfare assessment tool. So we were piloting a tool so we could get measurable, you know, data that we could work our projects on. And that's across all of Brook. That's something that we do routinely. But in relation to harness, because it was very new to Brook to have a specific harness advisor, it was a case of, I need to see what the problem is. You know, it's not something you can do online or with a book. You have to be there, speak to the community, see the animals, and not go to a situation where something has been set up for you to see. You know, it's seeing the real and seeing the rough. So I think my history with the RSPCA has helped me to be a little bit more resilient to some of the things that I see. But if anything, it makes me stronger and more determined to make a difference and find a solution for the long term. Constantly people will say to me, we can give you harness, you can take it there. But the problem is, a little bit of knowledge is a dangerous thing. So there's a misunderstanding. I've been sent pictures of harnesses that have been put on upside down. You know, I've had breeching straps wrapped around the underneath of the genitals. I've had all sorts of problems. I've had collars put, you know, behind the ears. And it's well intentioned, but that's not what we do. We would give people the skill to solve the problem themselves with some assistance. So it has to be designed and made locally. It's no good giving somebody an item because it'll either get sold or broken. And then what if it's broken? How does it get repaired? It has to be sustainable. And because of that, it takes much longer. You know, it would be easy to go to a community and go, here, everybody, have these wonderful, fancy Zilco harnesses with a nice empathy collar. It's not going to work. It's just not going to work. It's only a short-term fix. But there has to be an understanding of, this piece of harness does this job and it needs to fit in this area, and let's look at the anatomy of the horse. So with Senegal, one problem is that basically the breeching is a spider system. So they don't use cruppers, which I'm happy about because I've seen many problems. So the breeching will come down with the hip straps in a spider fashion. So it'll sort of have two or three straps, and it's adequate. It's webbing material, you know, it's affordable. They can access it. They can sew it into shape. So this is how it's been adapted. But the breeching was simply tied to where the saddle is. There was no holdbacks and there was no footman's loop. So nearly all of the horses and donkeys there had these awful wounds. They're still happening across the top of their tail, because when the cart hits the horse, it stops. So it's the cart hitting the horse that's actually the break. So I tried to discuss this with community members, but they wrap the traces round and round and round the shafts. And you can understand, being a driving person, what I'm trying to say. It doesn't work. It's almost like causing a snake bite effect around the girth area. And some communities were so desperate to try and solve the problem that they've started putting padding on the cart, which, you know, it's their attempt at trying to correct a problem.
Yeah.
So I'll say, right, we need the harness makers and we need the cart makers to extend the shaft slightly and to put a footman's loop. Because even if a community member purchases one of these breeching systems, if there is nowhere to tie it to, it's never going to be functioned. We also have to consider the fact that not one of these horses has a swingle tree, and 85% of them, because we've done the research, has open wounds on their chest. So why do they not use a swingle tree? And we've done so much research in Senegal in West Africa, and we can't find evidence of one. It's not a tourist area where you would go to some areas where there's tourists and it might be that they've bought an old carriage in that has one. So I can actually say, for the first time ever, we now have functional swingle trees working, being made locally in Senegal as of January. So the first visit was to bring the harness makers, the cart makers, and the bit makers, because the bits there are made from aluminium. It's melted down engine blocks and bicycle wheels, so motorbike wheels, basically. And there was a good research project done by Senegal with the bits and some of the bits are really severe. And I'll be clear about one thing. Pretty much all of the horses in most of the countries we work in are all entire stallions. A lot of the mares will work in the rural areas, so they will stay in the communities, but the mares wouldn't ordinarily come into the towns to work as taxis or transporting goods. They're kind of mainly the at-homes. It's slightly different for donkeys, but pretty much nearly all of the driving donkeys in Kenya are stallions. It's the same across India, Pakistan, Ethiopia, because it's not routine to castrate them. It's not the norm. And then obviously we have the strength of the animal. They believe that being a stallion gives it that extra willpower and strength, which can and can't be true. But then when I train them in the UK and they're driving a stallion and a mare together, they're a bit, wow. I said, it happens. It can happen. So in relation to Senegal, we have working swingle trees. We have some really good harness now being created in one of our clinical skills workshops in Mekkei with the pilot project. So we selected harness maker, cart maker and bit maker, all working together from four project areas, and they will improve one donkey and one horse. Then that will be rolled out. So I've now got some support coming from all of the training that I do is just checked by the Society of Master Saddlers, and it can carry their Fit for Welfare logo, which may not mean a lot to overseas, but there's nowhere else really that I can go to have what I'm developing for a specific context sort of checked. I'm all for, people reviewing what I'm doing, but it has to be somebody that understands the context. So it's no good saying, oh, you can't use rubber for harness. I'm like, there is no option. It's all there is. So how can we make that better?
Yeah.
And working with, Chris Taylor, one of the master saddlers from Saddler's Den. He's a fantastic guy. He's helping me with some developments for a pack saddle, which I'll be taking to Nicaragua next Friday, actually, to try and replace some of the wooden framed saddles that they're using in the mountain passes.
So you're doing saddler as well, because obviously the picture just behind you at the moment showing three donkeys from coming out of the brick kilns, presumably. When you talk about the saddles, is it this sort of load bearing saddle or
everything?
Everything.
So briefly, in Senegal, we don't have ridden. We have donkeys and we have horses pulling carts and carrying things on their back. But there is no mules, okay? In Kenya, it's pretty much nearly all donkeys. When I say Kenya, I mean most of East Africa. So we have a project in the Tanzania gold mines that's up and coming. So they predominantly, the donkeys there, they either carry wood, charcoal, firewood, gold, sand, lots of things they're carried on their back. And they also pull carts, so they will deliver water. And I spent time, I visited a fantastic community of women called the Women's Wise Group in Kenya, and they get their water from the River Maasai. And we had fantastic meeting with them, and all of their donkeys have names, which is a great step. They're part of the community, they're part of the family. And they have to travel long distances to deliver water. I met some ladies that had brought their donkeys to a place called Narok, and they carry charcoal, and it's very heavy. So we can improve the system that holds it onto their back with this little rope that goes under the tail, which causes wounds. And they can make things themselves from, fertilizer sacks, grass, the long straw. It's just how is it fit and functioning onto the donkey. So we know there's an area where they can load weight, which is not on the spine, not on the neck, not on the withers. Instead of just tying it on, it's an understanding of how we can tie it on. But these ladies, they'd walked about 30 or 40 kilometres each way just to get this charcoal there. And, I look down and they have no shoes on. So I have to, I don't judge people. I just think, how can I help them to help themselves to make things better? So that's the donkeys. That's Kenya. It's mainly donkeys. And then we go to India and Pakistan are very similar. And they have a lot of horses, donkeys and mules. So all three of the species. And they work in a variety of ways. They predominantly in the brick kilns. They will transport the bricks from the burner to the kiln with a cart. They have transport of goods by cart on the roads, camels and other animals I saw pulling carts, but there's a lot of horses and mules. And we have donkeys that carry things on their back and also pull carts. There's a lot of mules working in brick kilns. And I was there in August and I went to a coal mine and the reality is quite shocking. So the donkeys and the people there, they live in pretty poor conditions. They're migratory. They will live and they get, I think, one afternoon or one day a week off and they go into the coal mines. So they carry it on their back. They'll go down with an empty pack and it can be sort of 1 or 2 kilometres down in the pitch black dark. It's very hot. It's very dangerous. They'll load the coal onto the donkeys and then the donkeys come all the way back up. And even the men are having to bend down because it goes down to pretty much nothing. So they have a really, really hard job. But then we can make some improvements to the pack, the amount of work they do, the breaching, because it's quite tight. So I've got a project starting up in Pakistan to try and improve the breaching. When I say breaching, it's anything that goes around, you know, that area. Sorry, my email's notified me. And they're just really tight. They're just really, really tight and to the point that they're affecting the donkey's ability to walk. So we need to look at that and we need to think, how can they improve this with what they have? So that's India and Pakistan. Then I go to a fodder market where there's lots of donkeys, horses, and a lot of mules working in the town delivering things or flat carts, or they've got a different kind of cart there called a tunda where they have huge wheels. There is a skill in Pakistan where they can make the wooden wheels. And they will heat the steel rim with buffalo dung. So there's literally a ring of buffalo dung on fire. They can heat the steel enough to drop it onto the wood and then they can hammer it down and then they will put rubber on and they'll last a long time. So that is a skill with big wheel carts, but it's very specific to that region. And then I'll drive maybe a couple of hours to the edge of the desert and there's millions, and I mean millions of donkeys just... It's difficult to try and explain, you know, just how many working animals there is and how many different contexts. So we talked about Senegal, we talked about Kenya, India, Pakistan. Ethiopia is an interesting situation because a lot of people rely on their equines for their livelihood. So these are horses and donkeys and mules transporting by cart. The carts are very heavy. They're not very well balanced. From the latest study in one particular area where we have a handling and a harnessing project, I think 100% of them only had one band. So is it a girth or is it a belly band? It's doing the job of both. So it's an understanding. There's no swingle trees. There's no breaching. It's just bits of rope. The carts are falling apart. It's just half a car. But there is no skill, like as in there's no harness maker. So I know that we've got ideas to get some sort of a training facility in a shelter that's currently being built where we can cascade some sort of basic training down, but it has to be in the context. So it's very difficult to take a harness maker from the UK that's used to dealing with the best of everything and having leather and making a phone call and everything gets delivered to then going in a community where we struggle. The tyres alone are a problem because it's the old rubber tyres and they cut them into strips. And yes, it functions as long as it's well padded. But now the tyres are more modern, so they have a wire running through the rims. So they're losing the ability to get these tyres and they're getting more expensive. So they have to find an alternative. So we're looking at webbing straps and we actually managed to get one of our harnessing tech reps, a lady from Ethiopia to Senegal, and she joined in the workshop and she learnt how to make some really good quality basic breast bands and breeching and harness parts that can be replicated in Ethiopia. So we're hoping that we can extend that pathway down. So Ethiopia is still quite a challenge. There is a lot of misunderstanding in the way that they're handled. The quality of the bit is a huge problem. So even if we have the best bit in the world, unless we improve the handling skills, it's still going to cause a problem. And then also we could have the worst, most awful piece of construction steel as a bit. But if somebody has kinder hands, it will do less harm. So we have to consider both. You know, it's a combination of both. So I've done various things in Halibur and people laugh at me, but it's working. What can work and what can we do? So we made me and a friend of mine who's a farrier made a horse's head, complete with blinkers and a rein, out of wood, that can be folded and flat packed into a small case. And he now lives in Halaba in Ethiopia, and he has the reins attached, and he can turn left and right and up and down. And it might be something that's very basic, but it gives a visual when we're working with communities for them to hold the reins. And if they yank it, the head gets stuck. So immediately the first thing they do is yank and the head gets stuck. We can free it up again, but it's the way we've set the spring. But it means that we can have conversations without involving a live animal, you know, to try and monitor the way that they are handling them. So, I mean, I have a clip of a video which I mounted some little tiny cameras which weighed about 5 gram onto a cart while people went and did their normal working day, so we could get a good understanding of what's actually happening. What's the harness doing? What's the horse doing? How far are they traveling? What are the loads? How are they being handled? How many times are they struck? Why are they struck? And we learned quickly that one way that they use to get the horse or the donkey to go forward is to constantly yank, which is giving misguided signals. So the animals are very confused. So we have to look at how can we improve that, because we also think this is how this horse has been trained. And they are very, very strong, and they're only small, these ponies. But with this video footage, we worked out that the guy only travelled about 30 yards and he wasn't a cruel person. He just doesn't know any different. And he yanked it something like about 24, 25 times. And these are quite serious, sharp yanks. So we think this is constantly pulling here. When I've opened the mouth after doing a mouth assessment, I can see the bit, it's not in the right place. There is no dentistry. So it's a huge challenge, but it's difficult to overcome your own feelings sometimes and say, you know, this is awful, this is bad, I don't want to see this. I have to see this because I have to understand it. And then I have to think about how can we improve this situation in the long term? So it's not a case of just giving somebody a different bit. They have to have an understanding. So I'll take little plastic 3D models with me of the teeth, and we'll talk about where does the bit fit and what happens if the nose band is tight. You know, and they did that, and like, so they can see the teeth and the fact that they grind, and why the animal rears up when they put the fingers in the mouth is because it's painful. There's some huge sores in there. And I think when we have an understanding of the anatomy and what we're trying to achieve, it gives them a little bit more, well, they want to try and find solutions themselves. Like I said, the swingle tree, we explained what it was, what it needs to do. So a pivoting bar. There was no sort of copy design, and they came up with a system themselves, which I made some alterations on. And first of all, there was sort of a long piece of steel, which meant, so I'll use a pencil. It was attached to the underneath of the cart, but the pivoting point was here, which is going to cause extra pressure. But trying to explain that in Wolof, which is their local language, was difficult. So I just got a big stick and a little stick, and I just snapped the big stick, put the little stick there, and they went, ah. So it's communication, it's understanding and adult learning. But first of all, you have to, you know, I say build the trust. You have to build a rapport with the community. They, like, I'm a white woman. I don't know anything about horses. But then when they see a video of me driving horses, they automatically give me that bit of respect and go, ah.
But you move into these communities as a woman, and you're dealing largely with male, adult males, and they have a very, very different balance, don't they, societally, yeah, and culturally, between the men and the women. And sure, you know, you're charming and you're enthusiastic and you know, on a non-verbal level, there will be a lot of communication with the body language, yeah, and things which you have to do. But how responsive are they? I mean, are you invited into the communities, or do you as a charity and as an individual have to make headway yourself? What is the balance? I'm sure it's different every time, but are they responsive and do they invite you?
We have a whole team of, you know, vets and staff and community development already on the ground in that country working. So a lot of the work is done for me, but then obviously I will arrive and everybody needs to have a voice. So an example of that is in Kenya, working with a community in a little village, the side of Mount Kenya, where there's a lot of dairy donkeys. And it's a very, we don't get tourists there, let's just say that. It's a very close-knit community. And there's been lots of work through partner staff. So, you know, I adapt to their culture. We say prayers before we do any training, before every meal, after meal. Even though I'm not predominantly religious, that's their way. And they want to bless me and welcome me. And it's now got to the point where they've given me a local name, which is Kambura, which means bringer of rain, because there's a joke. Every time I come, they ask me for rain. So I'll say, it will rain at 4 o'clock. And at 4 o'clock, it rained. Yes, it's a coincidence, but it's kind of become a bit of a joke. And they said, when we were there last week, will it rain this week? And I said, on Friday, when we finish, it can rain. And it rained on the Friday when we finished, when we went for the meeting, and they couldn't believe it. So, and it was Valentine's Day, so I got covered in flowers. But yeah, and I think they, because there is, they get pride in what they do, and we give them a skill, and then they develop that skill, and they're excited for me to look at what they've done. But like, even the retraining of the donkey, so we can get them to move into pressure, because they've never had a breast band, it's all sort of around their neck. And we all know that when we're driving, there is a lot of groundwork that goes into it before we can just expect this donkey to understand what's happening. It's going to feel breaching for the first time. You can't just put them in a cart. We have to do some activities with compassionate handling. So we had sessions with some of the donkeys. And remember, a lot of them, they don't even wear halters. So the first thing we do is we have to get them used to wearing a halter and having things going over their head. Then we will move on to, we had just some webbing strap that had a piece of string across, getting the donkeys to lean into it and, you know, encouraging them that they don't have to stop when they feel the pressure on the chest. And it's a slow process, but the community, they get it. They're fantastic. They're really good. They understand why we're doing this. So when they finish their working day, they'll do a little bit. So by the time we go back, they've already done a lot of groundwork, and that support is not taken away. We've actually got the whole community down into a local hotel. They've had a live meeting with me and a consultant online. You know, they've put me on a big screen so that we can talk whenever they feel the need to, whenever they want to. We can develop this cart that we're having built. They can have a look at it. They can make changes to it. They can. Everybody can have their say. One of the ladies said, I wanted to say, can you make it gender friendly because I can't get on the cart? Yeah, we've added a step. We've added a little seat where they can still slide the cabbages underneath and the potatoes. And when we went back to the community this week, it's such an amazing opportunity for them. We have harness makers, which is a lady that makes bags and shoes a little bit at home. And we had another younger girl, Millicent, that's actually done some education for civil engineering, but there's no work there. And we have a situation where we've had men and women, and we've been teaching them how to fabricate steel and weld and cut steel to make the cart. And then we've got, you know, in Senegal, we've got harness makers are only men. There's no women that make harness. It's kind of not taboo, but it's not understood. So we brought Asta from Ethiopia, who was a woman from another country, and they all got on great, and they were teaching each other. So I understand what you're saying about, are you respected? And I think, when I trained as a farrier in my apprenticeship at Hereford, I was the only female with 42 lads. So back then it wasn't normal, but now it's 50-50. But I'll say one thing, I never bought a drink. It was great.
And one size really doesn't fit all, because we've listed, or you've been kind enough to list, just some of the differences that you come across. But is there a point, and is it part of the Brook policy, where you have, say, 3 or 4 visits, maybe 1 visit to a particular village or community or part of the world? And are you able to sort of sign off, or is there a case that it's an ongoing relationship? Is there a point at which you feel your work is done?
So if there is a specific project for a specific area in a specific country, so if we might say Brook West Africa as a whole, but at the moment we're focusing in Senegal. There's a lot of other areas to consider. You know, there's places that are a bit dangerous to go to, like Burkina Faso and places on the outskirts. It's just such a vast area. I think once our own staff are more educated, that gives us a better idea. So it might be that that project is for a period of this amount of time. And then we will possibly roll the model of that project into another area with a similar context. So the cart and the harness for these donkeys in Kenya, when that is up and running, we can roll that out to other areas. So little bit by little bit, we can spread the knowledge. But I think people need to see the improvements themselves. They have to understand why they're doing what they do. And somebody's not going to use something just because, you know, some white woman said, use this. So I will give them, I have harnesses and I will take harness parts with me, including a little happy mouth bit that I use as a fitting exercise. But I won't leave it there. But they get an understanding of the fit and the function and how can they use what they have to sort of follow those same principles. It's the one country I didn't mention where we have a lot of ridden is Nicaragua. So Latin America and Caribbean partners, it's a very small team and a very big area and it's extremely remote. So I've been fortunate enough to go once. And just travelling to each of the mountain passes itself was quite a task. And I'm going back next Friday with our farrier, Angus. This is why I'm going to be taking with me an alternative type of pack saddle. But it's not something I will leave there. It's something I will show them the design, find ways to improve it. Because I think one of the big problems there is the wounds underneath the tail from the crupper. And that's from when they're ridden. And when they pack, and we have some very small mules and they are ridden many, many miles because there is no road infrastructure. So these guys, they collect coffee, cocoa, they're heavily involved in the milk production. You know, the kids will get up at 3-4 in the morning, milk their cow, fill the urns, load their mule, and then they will take it to a collection point before 6 a.m, deliver the milk. And if they miss the road point where the lorry comes, you know, it's... they've lost their income for the day. They then have breakfast and then they ride to school. So it is actually their only form of transport. And because of the terrain, it's very, very tropical. It's very humid. There's different types of sort of animal diseases that are there that we don't see. Different types of skin conditions, you know, fungal problems. Screwworm, I'll mention, is one threat that we just don't see that sort of thing. So when we look at the crupper, we have to ask ourselves, what's causing this wound and why is it never healing? So we look at the material. There's a lady up the road, Kate Hart. She makes side saddles. She's a master saddler. And we've chopped it open and had a look at what's inside. So we look at the material, what's available. I mean, they're like square. So we have the underneath of the dock and there's like a square, very, very rigid crupper put underneath. It's almost like a triangle. And then it's tied to the saddle. And then when I ask them why they're used, a lot of people don't know. They're kind of like, well, it's to keep the saddle in place. It's to stop them kicking. You know, it's to keep the tail out of the mud. Sometimes they'll tie the tail up to the side of the saddle. And some communities, they don't know why. It's just, why are they done this? So we have to discuss with communities what they're doing. And they have to accept that there is a reason to change. So there is a thought process through community development. And, you know, using the evidence data. So this is why we need the community development teams to think about human behaviour change. Because we can change what we do with people, but if that, are we only changing it because somebody's here? We will change the way that we behave because we're in the company of a certain person. And then we will revert back to how we normally are. But that long-term change, it takes a lot longer. So it's almost like...
Well, that was going to be one of my questions, was obviously... you know, these sorts of practices have been going on for hundreds of years. And for you to come in at this point in the 21st century with a Western outlook, and I know Brooke is incredibly tactful as to how you go about doing these things, and you have this huge sort of community liaison philosophy. But it is very difficult, as you're saying, to undo this. Now, is there a natural curiosity and concern by and large as to why these animals are being injured, or is it so commonplace? I mean, I know the statistics were that nearly every animal, you know, until the farrier initiatives took place, were every animal was laying just about, and it was so habitual. And is that the same sort of thing that you encounter with the sores and the ill-fitting harness and, you know, bad mouthing, as you say, no tooth care at all? Is it just accepted that this is what the state of the animal will be?
I think it's difficult. And again, I know I mention each context is a little different, but one of the huge problems is availability of the product. So if all they can buy is this crupper that they can meet someone who sells them in a mountain pass when they travel there once a week or once a fortnight, that's all they have. They don't have the luxury of pushing a button on Amazon and having it delivered. There's the cost factor, but then they might have to travel many, many miles to obtain something that is a little bit of a better standard. So it's kind of not always their intention. It's what's available. So there was a guy driving the horse in Halibur, and the saddle frame is awful. This is a cart saddle. So it's literally just a bent piece of steel. And there is two versions which I've had a deep dive into. One is an expensive one that comes from another region, which is made from a car tire, which obviously won't bend. Car spring, sorry. It's made from a very solid spring steel and it won't bend. The other one is locally made, which is more like tin. And literally within a few weeks, it does this, which is pressed onto the withers. And because there is a lack of padding on either side of the saddle, it's causing wounds on the withers, on the spine. And also we have to think about the lack of a girth, because everything is moving around. So we have the friction, the pressure, the wounds, the cart balance. But this guy, he got wounds on his horse and he needed to work the horse, because if he doesn't work the horse and do his jobs, his family doesn't eat. It's as simple as that. And it's a very, very difficult situation. And he took off his shoes, which were like little flip-flops, the sliders with the foam, and he tied them. He put them underneath where it touches the horse, and he got on and carried on work with no shoes, because they don't want the injuries to be there, but they're frustrated because they don't know what else to do. So if you give them a solution and it's achievable, then it rolls out across everybody. So yeah, it's kind of like planting the seed. So giving somebody an idea of this piece of harness does this job, but it shouldn't touch the spine and it has to be padded. So there has to be no metal in contact with the animal at all. That's one thing I'm strict on. So when I constantly move blinkers back and they've just stapled them to the brow band and the staples go in and they wonder why their horses have no eyelashes, you know, it's have a look at what's underneath. And we do this harness assessment activities with our staff. I do a draft activity where I'll have a tire and just, even though they're not horses, just explaining the draft power of the horse or the donkey. With what we already have, we have the same animal, the same load, and it needs to move from one place to another. Okay. Simply by moving the connection point on the draft will make it easier for the animal. And they get confused. So what I will do is I'll put a belt on and then I will attach this tire to the belt and I'll get them to pull it. Yes, they can move it. They have two legs. They can move it. But then I have a little fall arrest harness, which is very lightweight. Then I will clip it to a clip behind the shoulder blades. And they're like, wow, this is easier. I said, it's the same weight. You're moving the same distance and you have the same strength. Just think about which part of the animal is the strongest. So in other words, stop tying it to its neck and stop tying it around its waist. Think about where is the power. So little exercises where they can lean. And when I talk to them about the horse needs to push the load, not pull it, they get confused, but then they start to think about it. And yeah, that's quite rewarding when you go back and they've made some interventions. So, you know, if I could send you some, and I will, I'll send you some pictures, before and after pictures of a donkey that arrived at the shelter and it had wounds on its tail because the cart had hit it. The breeching was a little bit of rope hanging down by its hocks. It was awful. Then he spent a morning with our harness makers and cart makers. And then when he left the shelter, he had some nice, wide, furry padded breastband breeching. He had a swingle tree. There was a good distance. I always say at least the fist to the elbow, because they can remember that, between the animal and the cart. So we don't worry about things like kicking straps. These are working horses. They very rare that they would have a kicking hissy fit about having to work, because they've just done it every day. So yeah, it's very different to our horses that come out of the field really fresh. You know, they just go to work because it's what they do every day. Mm. And just emphasizing things like quality rest as well. That's really, really important. Yeah, sorry.
I was just going to say, going back to Sarah's question about, you know, when do you leave? Do you continue kind of indefinitely? Well, the harnessing project is a bit of an exception because it's so new. Like, this more formalised kind of like element of Brooke's work is relatively new. So looking back to the farriery project that we sort of officially launched, so the strategy in 2019, a framework came into place after that called the Farriery Mentoring Framework. And as Jackie said, we've got these various tools for measuring change using something a bit more statistical than or more objective than just observation. And so that Farriery Mentoring Framework says, well, once farriers get to a certain level of skill, competency, etc., then that's deemed an acceptable level of change to exit an area. And that is when we would consider moving elsewhere or from one brick kiln to another. So Jackie, I think have you got sort of plans to put a harnessing framework, mentoring framework in place?
That's the plan. I think if we think about veterinary, there's a curriculum. If we think about farriery, there is a curriculum. And this is what I was saying about the harnessing. The only sort of learning pathway that's officially recognised in the UK is through the Society of Master Saddlers, which is a different context. So with their help, with Francis Roche and Catherine Baker, and I think they've got a new president now that's very keen, we're going to be developing sort of learning modules, and maybe we will trial it in Senegal and then it can be rolled out in the long term across other countries. So, you know, it can be more in relation to that specific context. So it can be measuring for a breastband, and then they have to point out the anatomical points that they need to consider, and then producing a breastband, and then the final would be an assessment, a measurement, a making, and a fitting. And after the end of 12 months, they could get a certificate that could say, you know, assessed to do this. And even though it doesn't really mean anything as in the country, they're so proud to have some sort of recognition of the work that they've done. But it's something that we have to bring out in each context. So the first thing is to get our own tech recs up to speed with the training and then look at ways that we can develop a mentoring framework. So it's going to be slightly different to farriery and veterinary, but that's the aim. But I think it took me a while to get around every country to see the context first. And then
I think that is important, because to give people a sort of stepped and achievable learning framework. And I'm one of the other questions I was going to ask in relation to what you're saying, how much do you get to deal with the next generation? So the picture behind you, you know, this is a middle-aged gentleman who's probably got family made and have grandchildren. Do you have an opportunity to be teaching his children, his children's children? Because really and truly, that's the generation you want to get to. Is that part of what you try and do?
And the important thing about the harnessing tech reps, I think there's six of us, including myself, across the country, is a hardcore team of people that we will give extra training, extra knowledge. And some of them are already veterinary trainers, so they can actually cascade a lot of the learnings that I do down to their different countries. So I'm hoping that it's going to be a global setup of a team of people that, you know, one of them could go to a different country, and so there can be lots of crossovers. So they will come to the UK and we do a harness exchange trip for the first week in June. And so far we've had Isatou, one of the vets from Senegal. We've had Mukesh from India. We've had some visa issues, which is to be expected. But we're hoping this week to get Brian from Kenya, who is a fantastic vet. He actually won Kenya's Young Vet of the Year award this year. So very, very nice guy and very, very keen. But they have an interest in wanting to bring about change. We have Asta, who is a lady from Ethiopia. You know, she started making harnesses. She's going to be coming. And we also have one of our training vets from Pakistan called Tariq. So they're all qualified in their own right, and they're all very capable of delivering training in the context, but they have to have a deep dive in the understanding. So they'll come to the UK. They do various things. They do practical training. We used to use a place in Wales, but unfortunately they're going to live in Belize, believe it or not. So I've had a really good, promising meeting, and we're now going to be setting up a partnership with Bennington Carriages. Sue Mart, I went up to see Sue, and she's great, great, fantastic. Passed all my welfare checks, which I have to go and check, everything's okay. And it's an understanding that we're not teaching people to drive carriages, But it's a practical exercise to understand harness fit, draft power, swingle trees, but in a real life situation. So she's been really, really helpful. We're going to be having 2 days there. Then we spend a day. We visit one of the Riding for the Disabled centres that uses carriages. They've been fantastic with me. That's the Cavalier Centre in Shropshire. Then we went to one of the driving camps. It's a fun packed week, but it's extremely busy. We've been, like I said, down to Kate Etherington's and John McDonald's. We've been to Chris Taylor, who is one of the master harness makers in the country. He's fantastic. We'll be going back to him for the day. And then, for some bizarre reason, it works really well, but I take them to Appleby Horse Fair.
Oh, goodness.
I know, gosh. I know. Because it's the only place in Europe where we can see so many different types of harness, so many different types of horses. We can work as part of a multi-agency team with the National Equine Welfare Council. And it's about education, maybe communities that are not always that keen to learn. Yeah. And we spend time on, you know, the education tent. They see four-wheel carriages, two-wheel carriages, sulkies, harnesses at speed, full collars, traditional draft. You can see a bit of everything at Appleby. So because we are part of the multi-agency team, and I've done Appleby before, probably about 17 or 18 years now, and I used to do all the harness training for the RSPCA to all of the staff and the police and everybody when we were there, so how to remove it in an emergency, what to look out for, to try and stop people doing things like taking the bridle off while they're still hitched, and, you know, what we would take as common sense, they might not know.
Yeah.
And not to remove a harness from a horse and take every single buckle off, you know, because they kind of got a habit of doing that. The police were terrible for taking it all apart. It's just an understanding of the harness and the fit. So, yeah, successfully I've been twice now, and they can see tethered horses the way we tether them. They can see the Botox wagons, so they can see full collars. And they get a fantastic experience out of it, but at the end of every day we do what have you learnt today, and we'll break down all the different things we've seen. So yeah, it's a different situation, but to come from the back streets of Ethiopia to then go and see all of these horses. We will probably also do a trip to like a working museum, like I know Acton Scott have invited us and things like that, but a lot of the working horses in the UK, they're more agricultural, and that's not always the type of horses we're dealing with abroad. Yes, we will see some donkeys ploughing fields, but most of them are pulling carts or being ridden or carrying things on their back. There's not as many sort of ploughing implements. So,
I mean, it's just a vast project. Jess, I'd love to bring you back in at this point. I mean, it's infinite, isn't it? Because the world is not big or long enough for all this. But I mean, how do you even allocate the budget within everything else you're doing for this, with the farrying, the veterinary, and the training, and trying to the travel? I mean, it's a big one to fund as well, isn't it?
Certainly is, and we definitely have finite resources, so everybody sort of has to. It's been the planning takes place at Brook at the beginning of the year, so it's been a great big sort of planning few months for everybody, where people's desired plans are put forward to our executive leadership team, who then review it with the veterinary team. And then every single country wants more budget. Jackie wants more budget. Angus wants more budget. So with more resources, we can do more. But, you know, that is all dependent on my job and my colleagues to fundraise for as much as possible. Yeah, which is why there are definite plans to increase our reach and increase our fundraising capacity. Because, as you say, 100 million equids around, working equids around the world, and last year we directly impacted 1.8 million. So, but in the knowledge that indirectly that will be cascaded to millions more. Yeah.